So assuming that we're talking about this potency ripening at death. So we call all of that time from the creation right up to the beginning of mind in the future life, we call that the causal consciousness, causal consciousness link, and then the first moment of consciousness in that new birth is the resultant consciousness link. That's just one moment. Ensuring that there's this continuity, one link to the other. One link gives rise to the next one. Because the fourth link is the name and form, or the body and mind, of that future rebirth. So that is the body and mind link begins from the second moment of consciousness in the new life onwards. Is that clear? So now we can go through the links relatively more quickly. Name and form, or body and mind, refers to the five aggregates, which is body and mind, that exist from that beginning, the embryo, right up until the within the embryo, the embryo becomes a fetus, a viable fetus. So the viable fetus has all of the sense organs developed, including the brain, the mental sense organ, and so it is viable, it can experience life. But then, as we know, the full maturation continues beyond that point until we're actually born. So the symbol of the fourth link, the name and form, is, you can see there's a man rowing a boat. So the person steering the boat is represents the mind and the form. So the body is like a vessel which carries the mind. And the body and mind together, they carry all of the unripened karmic potentials from the past lives, as well as all of the seeds of the disturbing emotions, the mental afflictions in the mind, and also all of the seeds of the virtuous mental factors, the seeds of love, compassion, and so on, also are carried in the mind, like the body, like the vessel, as we wrote, is carrying all of these potentials into the future life. So as I say many times, that the new life, the person of the new life, acquires a genetic inheritance from mother and father, as well as a psychological inheritance from past lives, and as well as that, a karmic inheritance of the unripened potencies on the mind stream from past lives. So each new baby already has an individual mind, in as much as with such a variety of past experiences, they have all of these seeds and these potencies for an individual life. And I think we see that with identical twins, where their genetic inheritance is essentially the same, but psychologically, identical twins are definitely different persons. They have different personalities, different characteristics, and so on. So scientifically we say, oh, it must be some difference in their upbringing. But Buddhism says there can be differences in the upbringing, which definitely will have an influence on the personality of the individuals, but there's also the karmic and the psychological inheritance from past lives. Also, they can have a lot of very similar things. You know, there's uncanny stories of, you know, twins who may have been separated when they were young, and they get together when they're adults, and they hadn't had this communication throughout their lives, but it turns out that they have the same job, they marry women with the same name, they have their favourite colours, etc., the same. It's unbelievable similarity. I'm referring to a specific case where a man was taken to a hospital somewhere in America, having had a heart attack, and a few hours later his identical twin came in with the same heart attack to the same hospital. And I think it was then they had known about each other, but they're obviously twins, and that's when they found out that their wives had the same name. I think they may have been married on the same day. I mean, some incredible, incredible coincidence. I guess from the karmic point of view, well, okay, if two people have the karma to have exactly the same parents, to have exactly the same body, then they must have a lot of similarities, karmic similarities from the past. But still, there were differences. Okay, so body and mind. That's the fourth link. Then, with the development of the embryo into the fetus, remember the viable fetus has all of its sense organs developed and capable of functioning, as well as the brain, nervous system. So this is the next link, called the six sources, which means the six physical sources for awareness, for the mind to experience life. So there are the five sense organs, and the sixth source is the brain, which is the base of ideas and knowledge and memories and emotions, all of that, our sixth sense, which we call the mental consciousness. So the fourth link ceases when the fetus has matured to the point of viability. The symbol is used to, you know, in the diagram, it shows a house with six windows. So clearly the house is represents the body, and the windows are the sources for light, you know, where light can come into the house. Same. Our eyes are the source for seeing things, ears are the source for hearing, nose is the source for smelling, tongue for taste, and our whole body for the source of touch, and the brain, the source of thinking and ideas. All right, so this link, the fifth link, the six sources, then that lasts from the time the fetus became viable up until the baby is born, and immediately after birth there is contact, the experience. Contact is a mental experience of contact with the outside world, with the objects of the outside world. So, in particular, the tactile consciousness is said to be the main one. And in fact, in the Buddhist Abhidhamma, the tactile consciousness, the sense of touch, is the main physical sense, and the eye sense, ear sense, smell and taste are just modifications or variations of the sense of touch. So the symbol which is shown is a man and woman together in sexual intercourse. This is a very vivid illustration of contact of the object and the subject, the subjective consciousness, subjective mind, and the object experience by the subjective mind. So contact. Now, looking back, the karmic potency, it ripened, and we will talk more about that, how it ripened later. But you see, there was no choice for ordinary beings. When we die, we can't choose which rebirth to take, which karmic cause for rebirth to ripen. I say ordinary beings. The mind is too confused at the time of death, and it's too subtle. So that potency will ripen in the form of either a human rebirth, an animal rebirth, hungry ghost, hell being, or a divine being, or form and formless being. So there is no choice yet. Right? I mean, right now we can begin to choose our future life by generating the aspiration. If we think about, definitely don't want to be born as a hell being or a hungry ghost or an animal. And even a deva, a divine being, there's lots of pleasure, but their minds are so complacent that they can't generate the motivation to practice Dharma. So actually, best it would be to be born as a human, because humans have the intelligence, their brain is the best evolved to allow our innate intelligence to manifest, and we have a whole spectrum of experiences from extreme pain to extreme pleasure, and we have the ability to understand and to practice Dharma. So, during life, before we die, I mean, we're all approaching death, but we don't know when it'll come. So by just generating this virtuous aspiration to be born human in order to further our practice, creates a cause. It's an intention. And if we do virtuous actions and we dedicate these virtues with a thought, may I be born human in order to continue my Dharma practice, then we create potencies for human rebirth. If we want to be born female, we generate the wish to be born female. Or we want to be born male, generate the wish to be born male. It's up to us. In different societies, there are different advantages or disadvantages for being male or female. In ancient India and in many societies, there's disadvantage because women are suppressed and put down, are discriminated against. It's more advantageous to be born male. But in this day and age, with equality, the equality of the sexes, then there's virtually equal potential for males and females. And in fact, there is, particularly in today's society, there is a greater opportunity to learn and to impress others as a female. So, as the Dalai Lama said, yes, there could be a future female Dalai Lama, why not? It depends upon the society and how beneficial I don't know whether he said I can be, but how beneficial that Dalai Lama's life could be. So now, actually, we can start propelling our mind, consciously determining future rebirth. It's good to remember that and to develop the cause. But what's particularly necessary, the virtue to be born human, is essentially maintaining pure morality of not harming others through killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, and so on, and generating compassion and love and accumulating the merit, you know, through generosity and so on. So, if we cultivate that intention to be human again, and we create the causes through that intention, definitely we begin to determine our future life. Now, if we meditate, and if we are able to meditate on the subtle experiences of death, and as the Dalai Lama said, I practice dying 6 times a day, you know, meditating on the visions that it occur during the death experience, so that when it does happen, it's so subtle, we'll certainly be able to control the death process and ensure a karmic potency to be human will ripen. So that's possible. All right. So contact. We're back at the experience of contact. Sense object with the sense consciousness with the object. So we have had no choice. We've got this human body. The human body is a result of virtuous karma, but whether we want it or not, we've got it. We've got the sense organs. We have contact with sense objects, and there's feeling. The next link is feeling. So that's a mental factor of either pleasure, pain, or indifference, that depends upon the type of objects our senses meet. Pleasant objects, unpleasant, or neutral objects. So as it says, the experience of contact is the awareness of the objects which cause feelings, and then the feeling is the actual experience. So the link of contact is very short. It occurs with the first contact with the sense objects, and then there is the link of feeling. The feeling is the immediate result of contact. So, because of feeling, there is the link of craving. And craving is not it's not just attachment. It is craving to have more happiness and more pleasure, an attachment to happiness, attachment to pleasure, an attachment to the objects of pleasure. And it's also craving to be free from objects of displeasure, to free from objects of pain, you know, to separate from objects. So attraction and aversion are included in the link of craving. So as you understand, the mind stream still has ignorance, there's still self-grasping ignorance, the root of psychic existence, and then the link ignorance manifests when it initiates through craving, you know, craving or aversion, another karmic formation to set up a new set of 12 links. So throughout our life, we're having contact with pleasant and unpleasant objects. And when there's craving and aversion developing in relationship to those objects, and actions following that, new links of karmic formation are established on the consciousness. So our mental consciousness is not just the third link of one potency, our mental consciousness becomes the third link of countless potencies, new ones being established upon the mind stream throughout life. The symbol for feeling is an arrow piercing a person's eye. So the eye is very sensitive. You know, you get the tiny speck of dust in the eye, and you know, it really feels like something very big, you know, a lot of pain can come. So this symbolizes the link of feeling, which could be very small, very big, like an arrow in the eye. The link of craving is a person drinking lots of wine or beer or alcohol. That when we start, when we have a glass of alcohol, it's never quite enough. And another one seems so much more attractive. And then we have the second one, the third one seems even more attractive. So we overindulge. And so our craving is never satisfied. Craving to be free from things, craving to have things, is never satisfied. It goes on and on. Whatever sensory experience, you know, we've never seen enough nice films, nice scenery, nice colours, firework displays. Or, you know, we want to see another one. Hearing music, singing, etc. We want to hear and smelling nice perfumes, and etc. Tasting foods. We're never satisfied. We always want more and more flavour, more and more taste. And of course, physical touch, especially, you know, the physical touch of embracing another's body, the craving for these experiences, these contacts with the pleasant objects of the senses, totally dominates our life. You know, it's for most people, it is their reason for existence, to experience pleasure and not to experience pain. So that we live our lives expending all our energy in indulging in sense pleasure. And we see, you know, we can see the harm in overindulgence, and we may have some resistance to overindulgence, but so many can't resist. Eating too much, drinking too much, etc., etc. So the whole life is spent accumulating countless more sets of 12 links and not doing anything to overcome the link ignorance. Then, as we approach death, grasping, the ninth link, is even stronger craving, and it's intensified desire. And, you know, it's said to be fundamentally, it's desire grasping at existence. Not wanting to die, not wanting to suddenly disappear into oblivion, not wanting to separate from family, friends, etc. So this becomes very intensified at death. So it is this strong psychological grasping at life or at rebirth acts like moisture and warmth and sunshine that begins the process of germination of a seed. So, you know, a seed like the karmic potency has remained dormant over time, and then as we're approaching death, this strong psychological craving, we start to nurture that seed towards ripening into its result. The illustration for grasping is a monkey eating lots of food, and those who have been to Dharamsala, elsewhere where there are monkeys, lots of monkeys, you've probably seen that if you're giving food to monkeys, they will just grab and fight each other for the food. They don't even have time to swallow it, so they store it in their cheeks. And their cheeks end up they've got to get more and more. Have you seen that? If you look closely, you'll see that monkeys are so greedy, grasping, filling up their cheeks. And only when there's no more food will they go away and, I guess, begin to swallow it. So that's the illustration for grasping And so now we're really entering into death, and we're experiencing the visions of, you know, first the weakening of the form aggregate, the body, and, you know, we're beginning, which we've described, you know, other weekends, the death experience. So with the so the dissolution of the form aggregate, which is the weakening of the body, the dissolution of the feelings aggregate, and then there's the dissolution or the weakenings of our power of discrimination, the third aggregate. So discrimination is our ability to discriminate between this and that, between virtue and non-virtue, you know, to distinguish between things. So the dying person still has that capacity, and the dying person, without any Dharma background or religious background, because so many religions do prescribe how to die skillfully. But in general, the mind is becoming so upset at separating from family and friends, from our possessions, even from our body, from our life. And so we've still got this power, so we know what's happening, that we're dying and we're going to this unknown death. So this intense grasping occurs at that time, and that is the end of the ninth thing, which gives rise to the tenth thing, which has the name of existence. So existence is the link of the seed, the karmic potency, born, say, ripened through craving and grasping, and it gives rise to its result. And specifically, it says, existence is the mental factor of intention, that is the fully ripened result of the karmic potency established by ignorance and karmic formation, and has been prepared for ripening by craving and grasping. So, can you see? The second link, karmic formation, was the mental factor of intention, karma. And when that intended action finished, its continuity was the karmic potency, which was neither body nor mind. But that potency, born of the mind, is now ripened. So it ripens as an intention, similar to the intention which established it. So there's this is the tenth link. And so the intention, remember, what is the function of the mental factor of intention? It is that which attracts the mind to its particular object. So, if we created a negative karma, say, to be born as a dog, then the intention that is the link, the tenth link of existence, it is the intention, that movement of mind towards a dog rebirth. I don't know what you call it, dogginess. But it's dogginess. If it was a virtuous karma to be human, that intention will move the mind towards human existence, humanity. But you see, this occurs during the death when our discrimination is weakening. Then the mind becomes more and more and more subtle, but the descent into the subtle experiences of the death process was begun by the type of intention that arose, the manifest intention. There are subtle intentions, even in the subtle visions. Now, there's another point here which is very important. Geshe Sofa Rinpoche, who, you know, he taught in the US for a long time, is one of the Zopa gurus. In his big commentary on the Lumrim Chenmo, which you must read, There are 5 volumes put out by Wisdom Publications. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche attended many of those teachings. You know, Lunrim Chimbo, it's big. Lama Tsongkhapa's big text, it's about this big and quite heavy. When Lama Zopa Rinpoche was attending as many of Geshe Sopa's teachings as he could, he held a copy of the Lunrim Chimbo to his brow for the entire teaching. Right? And, you know, just totally alert. Now, we may say, oh, Lama Tsongkhapa, he knows the Lunrim. He's been teaching it to me for some. But this is, the Lunrim is the entire teachings of Buddha. Understanding the Lunrim is incredibly profound. And just Rinpoche's devotion to his guru, Geshe Sopa Rinpoche, and holding the text, is an incredible teaching for us to remember. Anyway, in that teaching, Geshe Sopa said, there is a third ripening cause for the 10th link of existence. Right? The two previous two ripening causes are craving and grasping. And this isn't like a link. But he said there's a third ripening cause, a secondary karma, usually mental, created at this moment. And here's the key phrase. A thought that is of similar ethical tone, virtue or non-virtue, to the main karmic seed that's being, or potency that's ripening. In other words, if when we're dying, and we know we're dying, if we can maintain our mind in virtue, no matter how awful we've been in our life, which would make it harder, but anyway, it's possible, if we can maintain our mind in virtue down to the absorption of the aggregate of discrimination, that third factor, that virtuous mind, will germinate a virtuous karmic potency for a human rebirth or a higher rebirth. We have a mixture of virtuous, non-virtuous potencies. If we lose it and we start getting angry, you know, angry at the doctors for not healing us, we're angry at our family for already fighting over their inheritance, you know, a lot of angry at our body, upset a non-virtuous mind, then even though we've lived a beautiful life and we've created so much virtue and we've helped people, but if we lose it at death and we generate non-virtue, we have no choice. That will ripen a non-virtuous karmic potency for an unhappy rebirth. So this is where at the time of death we can also influence our future rebirth, you know, us ordinary beings, by maintaining our mind in virtue and abandoning non-virtue. It's not so easy. I mean, that's when we're dying. It's not so easy to maintain our mind in virtue when we're awake and not dying in everyday life. It's so easy for somebody to scowl at us or say something, and it means, oh, we're angry at them, you know. We lose it, even though we're trying to maintain the virtuous mind. But, and of course, if we have been habitually non-virtuous, it's much harder to hold the mind in virtue when we're dying. But if we're habitually virtuous, we have the habit of holding the mind in virtue much easier as we're dying. So we have something going for us. All right. So there's some information here. You know, the link of existence, it's not just the potency created by the karmic formation, it's the fact of that potency being greatly intensified. Karmic formation and existence are both involved with the karmic potency, one in the formation, the other in the ripening. So when we use the term karma, it's not the potency itself. Karma is the mental factor of intention. So other information there which I've given you. Alright, so there's very important information in the notes there, most of which I've already mentioned. Why is the tenth link called existence? It's called existence because that is going to be its result, the rebirth existence, cyclic existence. So the in general, in Buddhism, existence, we could talk about the existence of the intermediate state or the between state. We can talk about rebirth existence as the existence at the moment of conception. The existence prior to death is after conception, the whole life, and then the existence at death, which is the time the clear light vision of death has arisen. So these are just breaking down the cyclic existence into these four periods. They are not the tenth link of existence. They're the result of the tenth link of existence. So the symbol for the tenth link is a woman who's at full term, ready to give birth. So this signifies that the moment when the karmic potency has been enriched to the point of existence is about to give forth its result, the rebirth result. All right, so everything's ready for that result to happen, and then the existent link continues in terms of time. It continues down through the subtle visions of death to the clear light. The existence link includes the bardo existence, and existence link includes the time up until the stream of consciousness, born on the most subtle wind, enters the womb of the future mother, or one of the different types of rebirth. You know, the spontaneous rebirth, rebirth from the womb, rebirth from an egg, and when they say rebirth from moisture, heat and moisture. So the 11th link refers to the karmically acquired aggregates, body and mind, taken at the first moment of conception, which resulted from the ripening of the karmic seed. So the existence link then went from that time as you were dying, when the potency was brought to full potential by craving and grasping, and then right through until the next life. So there's your connection. And then because you've had the connection, there is rebirth, and because of rebirth, the 12th link is aging and death, which are the inevitable results of every rebirth. So the symbol for the rebirth is a woman giving birth to a baby. The symbol for aging and death is somebody who's carrying a corpse, usually wrapped up in a sheet, to the cemetery to be buried, or in Tibet, cut up and fed to the vultures. And then the experiences, aging and death, is accompanied and followed by, we can say, the four links of sorrow, crying, grief, mental unhappiness, and disturbance. So the Buddha mentioned these so-called extra links to remind us of the unsatisfactory nature of psychic existence. There's the sorrow, the crying, and the grief occur as we're dying in the future life, and not only ourselves, but also every rebirth is associated with losing our parents, our friends, our relatives, but to death. So at any time during the next life, parents die, friends die, and we have crying, sorrow, lamentation, and grief. These are episodes unavoidable. And then there's a worry and disturbance of mind as we approach our future death. So we reflect upon this. We all rejoice so much when we hear that a new baby has been born, and you know, we buy presents to the parents and we congratulate the parents. We're also excited and happy to see the new baby, and you know, we've forgotten that life is full of disappointment, full of crying, full of disappointment. This new baby is going to hopefully grow up, but it's going to have aging, sickness, aging, and death, and its parents are going to die, and it's going to have all of the sorrows, all of the things that go wrong in life are potentially there. Okay, so that is the general presentation of the 12 links. Now, they don't occur 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in that sequence. They can occur in terms of one potency, that can occur in two lives or three lives. In terms of two lives, in the first life, you have the ignorance link, you have karmic formation or volition, you have consciousness link. Now, at the end of that first life, you have the craving and grasping, which specifically nurture that particular potency. And so they give rise to the existence link of that potency. So you've got the those five links, and then you die, and a result of that karmic potency created in the first life, in the second life, you have the remaining links. You have rebirth, you have name and form, you have the six sources, you have contact, and you have feeling. So the remaining links, and then you have aging and death, and so on. So that is the sequence of a karma occurring over two lives. You can't have it in one life, because your one life is already the result of previous karmic links. Over three lives, in the first life you can have ignorance, karmic formation, and consciousness link, but at death, craving and grasping and existence are related to another link. Assuming, right, this first potency in the first three links was to be born as an animal, but at death, craving, grasping, and existence are related to another potency to be born as human. So the result will be rebirth as a human. And so you have the body and mind. Yeah, the fifth body and mind, the six sources, and contact and feeling, etc. of a human. But at the end of that human life, craving and grasping, belonging to that original potency to be a dog or an animal, they nurture that particular potency. So now you've had two lives already, so that set of links, the craving, grasping, and existence links occur in the middle life, and then the resultant links of that particular potency, name and form, etc., occur in the third life. So that the third life can occur very soon, like straight after the second, or it can occur millions of lifetimes in the future. So that explains how one set of 12 links all can occur in a minimum of two lives or a maximum of three lives. If there are many lives in between, we don't count them because the links aren't manifesting. So that meditation on the 12 links. What is the good karma that you could... What is the virtuous karma? It is any... You know the 10 non-virtuous actions? What do you say? What?
One life, two lives, three lives.
Yeah.
So, good karma.
Yeah.
Imprints in our consciousness. So, how does it bring to karma?
The good karma brings a happy life.
Bring forward to our next life.
This life. You're speaking too quickly. So how does good karma in this life lead towards a happy future life or good karma in the future life or what?
How is the evidence of good karma for previous life shown in the current life?
I think similar to the experience that I talked about, that what Geshe Sopa said during dying, the third condition for whether a virtuous karma or a non-virtuous karmic potency ripens is whether the mind itself is in the attitude of virtue or non-virtue. So the mind in general, if you die with a virtuous mind of love, compassion, the aspiration to meet the three jewels in the future. So it's a devotion to the three, refuge, the best, most virtuous mind is refuge in the three jewels. That will definitely ripen a rebirth karma for a happy rebirth. So similarly, during our life, if we want things to go well, we've got to have not attachment for the pleasures of this life. Right? If we crave money, wealth, passing examinations, good career, beautiful partner, a Mercedes or BMW car, just for the pleasure of this life, right, the eight worldly concerns. So that is non-virtuous mind, and that craving will be an obstacle to getting the pleasant things we crave. Now, getting for the ripening of good karma in this life, to experience something pleasant in this life, depends upon the ripening of good karma, right? Positive karma. Same as when we're dying, the ripening of positive karma depends upon the mind being in the aspect of virtue. Not the eight negative worldly dharmas, but the eight positive attitudes. The dharmas in a positive state of... Well, we say, craving the happiness for others, you know, virtuous mind, speaking kind words to others, generosity of giving material things to others. The generous attitude is the ground state of mind which we need to ripen karma for wealth. So the cause of wealth is giving, is generosity. Because being generous will ripen past karmic causes, if we have them, to be wealthy. If we are selfish and we harm others, have greed, miser, pursuing wealth, and we break the law, we hurt others, we might get temporarily money, but we're not going to be able to enjoy it. It might be stolen from us, or we'll lose it, or things are going to go pear-shaped, upside down. Does that answer it? Yeah. And it's a really important question. And the same with negative things, you know. A negative mind nurtures the karmic potentials for things we don't want. For unpleasant experiences. We all think, yeah, of course in our society we need wealth, we need a good job, we need a career, we need education. There's no fault in having these things. There's no fault in having a BMW or whatever you want. It's our mental attitude, like things come. I use my own example. My car in Australia was wearing out, and I can't go back to say what I was thinking, but I needed a car. Living in the country in Australia, you've got to have transport. And a friend totally unexpectedly rang up and said, I'm exchanging my car for a new one. Would you like the old one? So he gave his old car, which just happened to be a Lexus. Not only a Lexus, but a Lexus in which he'd driven the Dalai Lama around Australia many times. So, I don't think I even knew what a Lexus was until he gave it to me, but it's an incredible car. But it wasn't something I craved. I must have created some virtue for this to have come. You know, I didn't. I know it's a good example, but anyway, it's a good story. You know, when I tell Tibetans that the Dalai Lama has been in my car, then they touch dust the dust on the car and they put it on their head. And they won't sit in the seat where the Dalai Lama sat. No way they'll sit in the back seat. All right. Yeah.
Is there other also karmic causes to be born into a particular religion or to have an affinity with a particular religion? Because you could be born into one religion and then turn towards another, but to be born there in the first place. Are there causes even for that?
Well, look, everything we experience has a karmic cause somewhere in the background. Certainly in Buddhism, we present what's called a perfect human rebirth, which is where you're born human and you're not one of the other rebirth states where it's impossible to practice Dharma. But not only are you born human, but you're free from wrong views, which reject Dharma. You're not insane or mentally incapable of comprehending the Dharma, and you have an instinctive faith in the three jewels. Like you just have to see a Buddha image, and there's this affinity arises. So yes, and you meet a qualified teacher, and on top of that, you have the freedom to practice the teachings, to study, meditate. A lot of people don't have that because other circumstances, they want to practice, but life, they have too many responsibilities. So the cause of that is indeed karmic, generating the aspiration to have a perfect human rebirth where you can meet the Dharma and continue your Dharma practice. Definitely, that is a karmic result. And I would imagine it will be the same for other religions as well. You, of course, in other religions, Hinduism, yeah, but there's no thought of human rebirth. It's either heaven or hell. So there isn't the aspiration to be born in a Christian country or a Jewish country where you can continue. There's just to avoid hell and go to heaven. So it's quite limited, but because it's not their knowledge, I think a person who has strong faith in the religion and they identify with it, Christianity or Islam or Judaism, whatever it is, they identify with it as something very good, and if they observe morality, which is taught by all most religions, pure morality, then they will indeed create the karma to be born in a society or a family of their chosen religion. Yeah, I think so. So if there are people
who are atheists.
Atheists, yeah. Yeah.
They have ethical behavior or moral behavior, but choose to profess no religion.
Yeah.
In that case, how does that propel that person forward?
Well, no problem. Buddhists are atheists. The point is observing morality of non-harmfulness and the benevolent action of helping others. That creates a cause. Yeah, that is the fundamental cause for human rebirth. And whether you're atheist or Buddhist, you can create a cause for human rebirth. Somebody's born as an animal as a result of non-virtuous karma.
But if a person is wealthy, one wealthy family,
as a pet in a rich family, you say? Yeah. The throwing karma, which causes the type of rebirth, is just one. And that'll be virtuous or non-virtuous. But throughout that rebirth, the continual experience of life is a result of what we call completing karmas. There are other, a huge variety of other karmas, virtuous and non-virtuous, which determine your experiences. So whether you're a human in a wealthy family or a poor family is completing karma. You can be an animal with good, like an animal is non-virtuous, throwing karma, but to be born a pet of the Dalai Lama is virtuous, completing karma. Or, to a family who really looks after you. But to be an animal, say in India, I often use the example of a dog on the railway station in Gaya, in Bihar, where you see incredibly miserable dogs, mange and skinny and incredible. They are the lowest end of society. So as non-virtuous throwing karma, non-virtuous completing karma. And even the rebirth results, not the end of that karmic potency. Yeah? In our discussion on karma, we said that, for example, the non-virtuous karma of killing, the rebirth result is to be born in one of the lower realms. But that's not the end of that karmic potency. There's also the result similar to the cause in terms of your experience and in terms of habitual behavior and even the environment are all completing results of that same karma. So, for killing, rebirth result is one of the three lower realms. When that life is finished and another karma causes you to be reborn as human, a virtuous karma, then still that original karmic potency which sent you to the animals before, it has completing results. So as a human, you'll have a tendency to kill or to delight in killing. You'll have a result similar to cause in your experience. You may die very young, you may be murdered, or you lose your life. And the environmental result will be that you will be in an environment which is very dangerous to life. Natural disasters, landslides, typhoons, whatever, could kill you. So, is that sort of what you were getting at there? There is so much to karma. To go into detail. Now, I'm just reading through the notes. A lot of the information that's in these notes you've already got. I'm just looking for important things to stress. Sorry? Left out the which? The meditating? Yeah, that's what we're trying to talk about. One thing, just to make it a bit more complicated for you, these 12 links are like the general idea. But one karmic potency is possible for one karmic potency to have the power to cause many rebirths. You know, from the text, there is, I think, a karma of slander. If you call somebody a pig or a dog, in an angry way, that the karmic potency of harsh words, of calling someone an animal, can be the cause for 50 rebirths as a pig or a dog. Just from that one potency. Or even more. And so that's just one illustration. And also, multiple karmic potencies could be the cause for one rebirth. So we've just talked about one potency, just so we can get an idea of what's going on. But actually, multiple potencies can be nurtured at the existence link to cause one rebirth. Right? So you can have multiple potencies, one rebirth, or one rebirth, one potency, multiple rebirths. So there's all this variation. So, just in general, meditating on the 12 links shows how all things arise from ignorance. So, if we investigate how to abandon ignorance, then we realize that we have to attain the wisdom realizing selflessness. Because that is the antidote to the link ignorance. We also understand that to gain this wisdom, we need perfect concentration. To have perfect concentration, we need to live in perfect morality. And to have perfect morality, we need to follow the instructions of a perfect teacher. So there are the three higher trainings. In the text, the Buddhist text, the three higher trainings are morality, concentration, and wisdom. So they're implied in the presentation of the 12 links. And also implied is the importance, the preciousness, and the impermanence of a perfect human rebirth. So, to meditate on the 12 links, then if we look at them as we've done, we progress from ignorance, karmic formation, consciousness, so we can see that forward progression, and then the reverse progression. So the forward progression is like the Four Noble Truths, the first two truths. The reverse progression is the 12th thing, aging and death. If we don't want to experience the suffering of aging and death, then we have to stop rebirth. Committing suicide is not the solution, because we can't help but being reborn again and experiencing the suffering will continue. So if we really want to stop the suffering of death and life, we have to stop being born as humans. How do we stop being born? We stop the ripening of karmic potencies as the existence link. To stop that, we have to stop grasping. To stop that, we have to stop craving. To stop craving, we have to stop experiencing pleasure and pain in an ignorant mind. To stop pleasure and pain, we have to stop contact with the objects. To stop that, stop being reborn with the six sources. To stop that, stop being conceived with body and mind. To stop that, we have to stop the consciousness link, the karmic potency born on the mind. To destroy the potencies on the consciousness link, we have to stop karmic formation. To stop karmic formation, we have to stop ignorance. So you see, the previous 11 links, we have to stop them, we have to stop the previous link. When we get down to the ignorance link, that is the weak link in the chain. Because that is preceded by death and rebirth from the previous set of 12 links. So, but the ignorance link can be broken by developing the wisdom directly realizing emptiness, which opposes, and direct realization destroys the ignorance. So the chain is broken. And that's why when the meditator on the path of preparation finally generates the direct realization of emptiness and enters the path of seeing, that's why the ignorance link is stopped. And so all past chains of 12 links cannot ripen, and no future sets of 12 links will ever be created by destroying the ignorance link. That is the weak link that can be bring an end to suffering in samsara. Now, to understand emptiness is, you know, it's tricky. And, you know, His Holiness Dalai Lama says, don't worry. We've got to hear it again and again and again. And each time we hear it, that will remove the veils from understanding emptiness. And then there will be a time when we're sincerely trying to work out what emptiness means, when we're ready, when we've accumulated the causes. He says it'll just be clear. It's like the eureka moment that I mentioned yesterday, when Charles Darwin realized natural selection as the reason for evolution. And, you know, Archimedes and the, so in science there are so many illustrations of individuals who've put so much effort into understanding observed facts but haven't been able to put them all together. It's like getting into a bath or some apparently unrelated action when it all comes clear in the mind. So definitely that will happen for us to realize emptiness. There's in the commentaries there, some people are just cutting wood for the fire. They've realized emptiness. So don't be discouraged. Be encouraged. Just the word, you know, the Sanskrit word shunyata, emptiness, voidness, should really generate enthusiasm in your mind and interest, and to approach the realization of emptiness, then we create karma. We should make prostrations to Buddha. Any aspect of Buddha, may I realize emptiness, and make virtuous actions. You know, feeding it. I always say feeding hungry dogs, but any hungry sentient being, or any virtuous action, and consciously think through this virtue, may I realize bodhicitta, may I realize the wisdom realizing emptiness. And that will lead us. We don't have to be a great intellect, you know, PhD, power of intellectual reasoning. Anybody can realize emptiness. It's actually not so difficult. We know the story of the monk who couldn't memorize one line of a 4-line verse. As soon as he started to memorize the second line, he forgot the first one, and then everybody thought he was utterly hopeless, and Shariputra kicked him out of the monastery. Anyway, Buddha gave him practices to persevere. And so this apparently hopeless mind had no memory. Eventually, realized emptiness, became an arhat, one of the 16 arhats. So, create the course, listen to the teachings, think about them, and then this will directly oppose the link ignorance. And if we support that aspiration with bodhicitta, that not just may I realize emptiness so I can get out of samsara, but may I realize emptiness so that I can show the path for others to get out of samsara. You know, for all others as one's purpose. And definitely it can happen. Don't just the thought, oh, I can't do it in this life. Next life I will. No. This life. You can, and we can, and we must. We must take the essence of our perfect human rebirth, because we know how rare it is to achieve again. So within the what we mentioned yesterday about realizing emptiness, Lama Tsongkhapa, as you've heard so often, and as I mentioned to Tommy, who was here yesterday, not here today, who asked, what's the difference between realization of emptiness and realization of dependent arising? Well, the meaning, they both, they're different understandings, but they mean the same thing. And Lama Tsongkhapa said, this is the jewel, this is the most precious, praiseworthy aspect of Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching the Dharma, teaching dependent arising. Because we can see, for us, it's very easy to see how things arise in dependence upon causes and conditions. We can we can experiment. We can establish our mind in virtue. Particularly, there's a person we never get on with, and we don't look forward to meeting them. It always ends up in misunderstanding or argument. We don't like them. So, if we set our mind prior to meeting this person in virtue, if we reflect upon their positive qualities and we generate some degree of affection and warmth towards them, like we do, this is the day when we know we're going to meet this person. We don't want to, but we have to. Okay? So, oh, fantastic opportunity for experiment. So genuinely set your mind seeing them in a favorable light, and then you don't have to go overboard and embrace them, kiss them, you know, a bit too much. Just subjectively feel good towards them and see how the meeting goes. And they probably can't bear the thought of meeting us. They don't like us. They're not looking forward to the meeting just as we don't want to meet them. So they're the same. But we, with this good heart, they pick it up. And suddenly we're not as horrible as they thought we were. we may have been more horrible than they thought we were, but in this time we don't become horrible, and we see that they change, that their relationship changes. So that means that gives us some insight into many things. But one thing is dependent arising, that we thought this was an inherently existing annoying person. We really did. From our side, we saw it was part of their nature, inherently existing. And so by changing the conditions, their annoying qualities were diminished, hopefully removed altogether, but not necessarily. What we see as annoying anyway. And that's important. You see, we see them as inherently existingly annoying, but that's our problem. And they're not inherently existing annoying. So if we have reflected upon their good qualities and we see them in that light, then we're seeing a different person. We are focusing on good qualities. And so what may have been annoying towards us in their behavior in the past is not annoying anymore. In fact, we don't even see it. So you see, we see that an inherently existing annoying person is something dependent upon cause and conditions. Yeah, something from their side, but also from my side. If I change my subjective approach to this person or this situation, the situation changes. Nothing exists from its own side, independent of causing conditions, that I think they do. So that opens our mind to emptiness. That is the meaning of emptiness. All phenomena are empty of existing inherently from their own side. By changing just our subjective relationship with people and with circumstances, the people and circumstances change. They're different. They're empty of existing so concretely as I thought they did. So, you see, you can see the interplay between emptiness and dependent arising in this context. So it's to just have the mind hear the word emptiness is such medicine for when we're upset and, you know, we think life is so awful and we're depressed or full of anxiety. To work upon our subjective take or attitude and to experiment changing it. And the things to which we're so attached, you know, the other way, we're so attached, inherent existing good object or person, and we exaggerate them as being so super, super good, as our mind thinks, but see, well, they're not really. There are some imperfections, this and that, and yeah, they're not inherently existingly essential for my happiness. My craving is craving a figment of my imagination. So instead of having craving, we still think of their good qualities, and we have affection for them and love, but not craving, not thinking, I can't be happy without that person or that object. That they're empty of existing so perfectly as I imagine them to be. So again, emptiness and dependent arising. And dependent arising refers as the objective side, subjective side. So this is the material, the field which we can work with 24 hours a day, even in dreams. We can change our dreams, not talking about lucid dreaming, but It should come to our mind that practicing morality or some from our waking consciousness we can incorporate into a dream and change the direction of a dream. When I was a kid, there was no television in Australia, definitely no internet, and so there were films at the cinema. And I used to like scary science fiction films. And I remember in our house, we didn't have a toilet inside, it was in a little shed down the back of the yard. And one night I'd see this really scary science fiction movie. And I was back home, and it was dark. I had to go to the toilet. It was outside in the dark. And I was scared. And I remember distinctly standing on the back steps, scared to go into the dark. And I said, and I remember telling myself, it was just a film. Those monsters are not in the backyard. There is nothing to be scared of. And I went to the toilet, no problem. So, in our life, when we're very worried, or upset, or attached, craving, tell yourself, it's just like a movie. Your mind, you are creating your own enemies, you're creating your own objects of attachment. They don't exist the way you think they are. And then suddenly the intensity, the fear or the craving will subside. That is meditating on emptiness and dependent arising. They support each other. So that's how eventually we'll cut the first link, the link ignorance.
Because I know you're ending. Going back to the first lecture, and you started with Buddhist cosmology.
Yeah.
Then you went into mind and mental factors. So, of course, it's been wonderful having these 6 weeks. I just need to understand why is it so important to open with Buddhist cosmology and how much of that should I, let it sink in to tie in with mind, consciousness? I think that's the thing that I'm always battling with because I find it very hard to talk about Buddhist cosmology to non-Buddhist friends.
So why did we start with Buddhist cosmology?
I mean, yes, the six realms.
And the six realms.
Yeah.
Why did we start with the 12 links?
Let's see. It's an example. I mean, why is the Buddhist cosmology?
I see. There's a very profound reason why we started with Buddhist cosmology. Because that's my favourite subject. Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for bringing up the first talk because 6 weeks have gone so quickly and I've thoroughly enjoyed myself here in Singapore and I've enjoyed your attention and your enthusiasm have been most warming to me and I've put in a lot of work. I've read so many books from the library. So it's been a good retreat for me. And so collectively, we've created really good energy together, great energy together. So let's dedicate all of this accumulated positive energy to other sentient beings by thinking that through this, may we all, hand in hand, follow the path to enlightenment and become perfect guides to show others the way out of suffering. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gatsu. Today, as you all know, it's our last session here with Venerable Gatsu at EBC, and it will not be the last, I'm sure. So I'm glad you all have enjoyed his teachings during the last 6 weeks that Venerable Gatsu has been here. He's been so kind to come to Amitabha Buddhist Center after a lapse of almost 20 years to teach at our new building here today and to continue the spread of the Dharma among us. This is part of the program of Amitabha Buddhist Center, always after Ken Rinpoche departs in October for Kopan Monastery, where there is a lapse here for the holiday season. We always make it a point to invite other Sangha members to augment our teaching program. But as you can see, this program is aimed at a more beginner level, the 101 Buddhism level. They can be presented in a way that only lay people outside can understand Buddhism much more easily, and that you can understand the logic and they can maybe use this as a part of their lives from a practical point of view. So these teachings have been organized with this objective in mind, and it's always been the policy and the mission of Amitabha Buddhist Center here to be able to continually bring the precious Buddha teachings to all people in Singapore, to all of you here who have the karma to have the interest to be connected with us. We're always here to provide the precious Buddhist teachings to the general public. I think for the last 30 years, all of us here have endorsed and embraced the philosophy and the hardcore belief of our spiritual masters, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, that the essence of any Dharma center must be the propagation of the precious Buddhist teachings, that it can be of some purpose to your lives, that to show you a different perspective of what life can be all about, and this can be applied to your lives and leading to a much happier life. So this has always been the advice of our spiritual masters, and we're also very grateful that through the blessings of our spiritual masters that we have this opportunity here to erect this beautiful building, and also the connections to invite so many lamas and visiting teachers. I don't know if Gatsu is a long-standing monk of 40 years, I believe, or 45? 44. A round of applause. He's been a Sangha member for 44 years under pioneers, the FBMT, under Lama Yeshe. So Venerable Gatsu really, has been a pioneer, and through his dedication and his perseverance, keeping his ethics very pure, that he's able to accomplish so much and be with us here this 6 weeks to share with us the precious things of the Buddha. So on behalf of Amitabha Buddhist Center and all your students here, can we say a very, very deep sense of appreciation and thank you. Thank you, thank you for coming here to teach. So I'd like to present a token of appreciation to you.
A symbol of a 1,000 Chen Rezi, a gold medallion. For Amitabha Buddhist Center for your Buddhist work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you.